Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Aris LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 353 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I have spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I've been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden. And I've been charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade. Every garden is unique. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. We start this week with Pedro Mura in the Los Angeles Times Plants newsletter, the latest published on July 15th in the Times. After a wet, hot winter, summer fruit trees in SoCal are suffering. Welcome to midsummer. I hope you've been enjoying the fruit of the season. I know some of you might have been missing some old reliables this year. I wrote a bit about that today. Joanna Glovinsky runs a local fruit tree pruning and education company called Fruitstitute. She started it in April 2018 with the stated goal of making every Angelino fruit tree literate. Since then, the Montecito Heights-based organization has grown to serve more than 2,000 clients across Los Angeles County. In May, Fruitstitute encountered an unprecedented challenge. All over the region, its clients started emailing with a simple but serious question. What happened to my trees? Local plum, apricot, and pluot trees have not produced near their norms this year. In many cases, trees that in years past have been filled with fruit are this year barren. In the 8 years we've had Fruitstitute, this has definitely never happened before, Glovinsky said. On average, the messages have come in at least 5 times a day, every day, for weeks, Glovinsky said. Frequently enough that Fruitstitute decided to devise a standard reply. After enough emails, they penned a newsletter on the subject and sent it to all their subscribers. It's not you, Glovinsky said in summary. It's not us. Who then is responsible? Blame the heat that climate change has brought us. More specifically, blame our indecisive weather over the last 9 months. Many parts of Los Angeles received more than 7 inches of rain last October and November, which is more than the region had received in those months since 1967. It looked like it was going to be a great year, Glovinsky said. Then we heated up, registering the hottest December through February on record. Sensing that winter was over, the fruit trees started flowering. But much of March and April were rather moist and cool, causing concern. No one knew exactly what to expect. It turned out that in many cases, trees simply dropped their flowers, leaving nowhere for fruit to set. Winter came back and all the flowers died, Glavinsky said. Some Redditors have reported the same problem in sullen language. One person wrote their plum tree decided not to produce this year and wondered if others had made the same choice. Generally, the issue has not affected local peach trees. Most did not break their dormancy during the winter heat wave and thus did not have flowers to lose during the so-called second winter. But you can spot the effects of the weird winter weather at local farmers markets. Most farmers who sell stone fruit at LA's farmers markets grow in the Central Valley, where the climate's typical chill hours are better suited for stone fruits. There, too, they had a wet, then hot winter, although in less extreme fashion than Los Angeles. At the Atwater Village Farmers Market on July 12th, farmers reported that most of their fruit was fine, but notably ahead of schedule. G Farms in Exeter harvested plenty of plums and apricots to sell. Among their offerings were ripe August yummy plums. As you might have guessed, the plums are so named because they typically ripen in August. Ken's Top Notch, a prolific grower based in Reedley, California, reported that its fruit is also softening sooner than usual. The grower had been recommending customers eat or refrigerate fruit within 2 days. Farmers and many seasoned backyard gardeners know that every year is different. No tree or orchard is a guarantee to produce at its peak in any given year. But no one expects a reliable, perfectly pruned tree with pollinators all around to be barren throughout a growing season. Here's hoping next year's harvest will bounce back after our likely El Nino this fall. We turn now to updates to the Southern California event calendar, and the following are upcoming events July 25th to the 31st. As this is scheduled to be broadcast on the 23rd, we'll only share those events from now and through the end of the month. On July 25th, CD Saturday at Arlington Gardens, 9 to 11 a.m. in Pasadena. Antonio Sanchez, a longtime native plant nursery manager, will lead a free class on native plant propagation, which will be held at Arlington Garden in Pasadena and hosted by the Artemisia Nursery of El Sereno. The class is offered in English, but Spanish translation is available. Eventbrite.com is the website. July 26th, Herb Walk at California Botanic Garden, 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. in Claremont. Herbalist William Brone will lead an interactive garden walk with a focus on medicinal and edible plants native to California. The traditional and modern uses of 15 to 25 species will be discussed. Tickets are $30 or $25 for members. CALBG.org is the website. On July 30th, Landscaping for Wildfire Resilience, 6 to 7:30 p.m. online. Theodore Payne Foundation horticultural educator Eric Blank will suggest strategies for the home garden to enhance wildfire resilience. Blank will also address our region's native habitats and fire history. The website is theodorepayne.org. And July 31st, the Golden Hour, music in the garden at the Norton Simon Museum, 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. in Pasadena. The museum's newly renovated sculpture garden hosts a North Indian ensemble playing the violin, cello, and tabla. Tickets are $20 for adults, $15 for seniors, and free for children and students, and museum access is included. The website is nortonsimon.org. And that is it for our update and schedule from the Los Angeles Times. Southern California is not the only place to have faced dramatic heat this summer. We turn next to a recent column by Robin Lane Fox, published on the 9th of July in the Financial Times of London, How to Protect Gardens and Pots from Heat Shocks. Even brief temperature spikes can kill plants or stress roots, particularly if they are overplanted or in plastic containers. Short, sharp heat is a long-term shock to gardens. Investors will remember Warren Buffett's famous remark about a sharp shock in stock markets. You only find out who's been swimming naked when the tide goes out. In gardens, you find who has been planting thoughtlessly when the heat soars. It exposes carelessness about containers and what goes in them. A word first about pots. Plastic pots still predominate as containers for plants sold for replanting. Purists object to them on strong ecological grounds, but most of us still end up with them after shopping on impulse. I returned from a recent flower show with half-hardy fuchsias to brighten up summer on the terrace outside my windows. I had bought too many, so I planted the surplus in a few pots of black plastic which had arrived round shrubs planted out in the spring. I was away for the first 2 days of the heat wave, whereupon those fuchsias shriveled in its intensity. Plastic pots transmit the heat through their sides and affect plants' roots where they are most vulnerable. Those in clay pots survived unscathed. Their sides are thick enough to absorb the heat, and when they are watered thoroughly, they retain some of the water and keep the temperature down for a while. Do not economize, especially if your garden is in pots on a hard surface. When I am being hyper-friendly to the environment, I use so-called hairy pots made of coir and natural latex, admittedly materials brought in from abroad. They give younger plants a good start and biodegrade when their contents are taken out and planted in the garden. Become a Harry Potter by buying these pots at good garden centers or checking out their main supplier, Curtin Farm Nurseries near Winchester. Wholesalers only, but with a good website which lists retailers in the UK. And that website is Curtin Farm, KIRTONFARM, oneword.co.uk. Many plants from growers arrive in spongy non-soil, sometimes riddled with peat, seldom weighed down with well-mixed loam. We blame ourselves for deaths in such plants before or after planting, but we are usually not primary culprits. I take all such plants out of their pots on arrival and soak them in buckets of water until bubbles cease to appear from the root balls. As a general rule, overlooked in a hurry, I also repot them for a while in appropriate John Innes compost and only plant them out when they are well rooted into it. If not, what happens? Sudden death. In some cases, surprising even hardened killers like me. Here is a recent example. In early June, I was given a potted ceanothus, the good evergreen autumnal blue, in a plastic container full of its nursery's growers' non-soil. I delayed planting it and left it, meanwhile, in a sunny, south-facing aspect. After 1 day at 37 centigrade, it was scorched to death and had to be thrown away. Black plastic nursery pot and its apology for real soil overheated intensely and killed the plant within hours, hardwood and all. If you buy a plant potted likewise, soak it in a bucket and plant it at once. What about those slatted wooden boxes which have been proliferating in cities, blocking streets to traffic and signaling green virtue to onlookers? Devoted country mice like me used to wince at urban incomers who made a bit of London in the country before returning to it from Monday to Friday. The phrase has now been reversed. Ancient Romans, also caught in a megacity, had a phrase, rus und urbe, coined by the poet Martial around 100 AD. It means country in the city and referred to a friend's green park in Rome. No doubt you have watched suffering examples near you. For 5 years now, I have been pained by frightful slatted boxes dumped by the Oxford City Council along Broad Street in Oxford as if to make it rural. The slatted wood, I reckoned, would not be the killer. Heat and overplanting would surely deliver a coup de grace even to the ornamental grasses inside. I winced as the scheme went in, packing rampant acanthus, fleshly-rooted and yellow-leaved Choicea sundance, a shrub up to 7 feet wide at maturity, among purple-leaved formiums, thuggish in company, semi-hardy Verbena bonarensis, perfect for butterflies, quote-unquote, straggly lavender and purple-leaved hebes, which are also on the margin of hardiness. The spacing was a horticultural crime, cramming plants for a long border into an area about 2 meters square. The multicolored leaves are a blot on one of the city's most famous streets, with views through long parts of it to wonderful architecture, Christopher Wren to the fore. Longing for the boxes to burst apart, I watched tourists sitting on the slatted seating until bees unsettled them, and their lattes in disposable cups. With much swiping and swishing, they left pseudo-rurality and returned to the safety of the pavement. Successive dry summers would have killed off this gesture to fake wildness, but artificial watering saved it, applied from carbon-heavy vehicles stealthily before dawn. In the middle of each container, hasty planters had stuck sapling amelanchier trees too and forgotten to cut off the trade labels. Amelanchiers are trees which like to grow tens of feet high. Billed as multi-stem, they intensify competition for the plants beneath them by suckering from the roots. They flower for only a week or two, their usual span in spring. Their leaves might have changed into a vivid red in autumn, but they had already gone brown-red in summer and dropped off. While this dire scheme was trialed, then extended, a similar blight of pseudo-rusticity hit London. That preposterous artificial mound of dying turf and wooden slatting defaced London's Marble Arch, purporting to green it in summer 2021. The cost reached £6 million, and when a public outcry forced it to be removed 7 months later, the removal cost a further £660,000. Meanwhile, Oxford's scheme, touted as one for native plants, borrowed ever onward with multinational planting from New Zealand to Argentina. In just 1 week, the short, hot shock has put it out of its misery. Hebes have burned and died, and like a number of their brothers on roadside planting out of the city, many of the amelanchiers have died too. I would chuck the whole disaster out and drill ample holes in the street's asphalt for a line of ginkgo trees, those beautiful survivors from the pre-glacial era. They grow so well and look so lovely in streets in Manhattan and Seoul. Ginkgo Princeton Century is an upright variety, manageable and beautifully colored in autumn. I would also cue some upright varieties of parotia or ironwood to vary the treescape. They are excellent in autumn, and at the top of Kew Gardens' informed list of trees for the hot summers of the future. If black plastic and non-compost do not kill it, overplanting and misselection will. I could multiply the Broad Street fiasco with similar stupidities all over England. Soundbites about carbon capture, rewilding, and saving nature can lead to painfully slow deaths when misapplied. A fig leaf of urban hypocrisy is not a protection against summer overheating. We turn next to an article by Marion Willingham, published on July 2nd in the Financial Times. What could your seed packets grow into? The market for vintage flower and vegetable packaging continues to bloom. It's probably one of the smallest hobbies in the world, says dealer Dwayne Rogers of the market for vintage and antique seed packets. Not that this has stopped him from selling thousands of the paper sleeves printed with colorful illustrations of flowers and vegetables. Decorators are the ones who really buy a lot of them, says Rogers, a.k.a. the label man, as he is known on his eBay store and website. The history of seed packets stretches back to the 18th century, when naturalists such as John Ellis preserved and labeled their botanical finds in paper. I would suspect as long as seeds have been stored or shared, there has been packing to enclose them, says Philip Norman, curatorial volunteer at London's Garden Museum, where the oldest examples are Italian. folded paper envelopes with handwritten labels from around 1880. In the U.S., the Shaker community began selling their seeds in paper packets rather than cloth bags in the late 1700s. A set of six plain brown packets from the Enfield Shaker's Garden in New Hampshire, printed only with planting instructions, sold for $1,625 over a high estimate of $600 at Freeman's Auction House in 2022. More common are the illustrated versions that proliferated in the 19th and 20th century, whose botanical designs, rather than their contents, entice enthusiasts. American companies led the way with printing, says Norman. Major manufacturers, including New York-based Burt's Seed for Quality and F. Lagomarsino and Sons in California, worked with lithography companies such as Schmidt, Galloway, or Genesee Valley. The artists behind the colorful illustrations, meanwhile, remain largely unknown. The subject may be niche, but it's also highly accessible. You can get seed packets that are 100 years old for $3 or $4 each, says Rogers. Examples from Burt's in the 1910s are among the oldest in his collection. Those for beetroot, onion, and radish are priced from £6, while a large packet of fancy mixed sweet peas is £7. Rice's seed packets are rarer. Its famous Ruby King pepper, the best for pickling, and California cream butter lettuce, immense heads as solid as a cabbage, sell for £19 each. The main determinant of price, says Rogers, are scarcity and appearance. If it's an ugly packet, nobody's going to want it. Age is also a factor. Packets that were produced before the 1930s, when businesses switched from lithography to photomechanical printing, command a premium. Oregon-based illustrator Katie Lombardo prizes a set of 20 delicate French packets that date from the late 19th or early 20th century. She found them in an antique shop for $25, but notes if you're purchasing online, it's going to be a lot more expensive. She also loves Wildflowers of the West, a packet distributed as a free gift by the Richfield Oil Company from the 1930s onward, which features an array of native Pacific slope blooms on a deep blue background. European packets are rarer, and their color palettes much more gentle, says Louise Allen, who co-runs British garden antiques business Garden and Wood. Her current stock includes a set of six French Semence Selectionne vegetable packets from the 1950s, £24, but most sought after are early examples from the UK, which are priced at up to £15 each. Those by well-known brands such as Sutton, Webbs, and Carter's are prized for their rarity. Welsh dealer Orchard Garden Antiques currently has a variety of 1970s Webb's root vegetable packets priced at £12 for four, with the original seeds still sealed inside. An important bonus for collectors, says Allen. Discoveries of surplus stock can rock the market, either revitalizing or flooding it. About 10 years ago, when some 3 million packets from Texas company Lone Star in the 1940s to the 70s were unearthed, everything changed, says Rogers. People started doing sets of 70 packets for $50. More fruitful were the boxes from 1920s and 30s Everett Seed Company packets he acquired a few years later, which were featured on a set of stumps issued by the U.S. Postal Service in 2013. Rogers' wife is selling a set of stamps alongside the corresponding seed packets for $239.99 on eBay. The most amazing item we ever found was a British seed box by Carter's, with its contents complete, says Allen. Inside was a collection of Dig for Victory seeds from the 1940s. They had gone into somebody's loft and sat there forever. The whole set sold for £1,500. Now Garden and Wood has some seeds from 1942. Cabbage, sprout, lettuce, and parsley, six for £36, as well as an empty Carter's salesman's box, 75 pounds. Boxes and sale racks are popular for storing or displaying vintage collections. Alan is a fan of Sutton's For All Parts of the World tin, advertising all the continents the seed company supplied, 88 pounds. Some prefer to frame their finds, while decoupage and cur enthusiasts affix them to tin cans, tabletops, or even whole walls. Whether you collect a particular flower, hunt out historical crop varieties, or try to complete the set from a particular company, the joy of vintage seed packets comes down to their improbability, says Alan. What's the chance of a piece of paper surviving 100 years? Just the fact that it has is quite special. What follows is a guide where to buy. eBay is ebay.com, one word. Freeman's at freemansauction, one word, .com. Garden and Wood at gardenandwood.co.uk. The Labelman at thelabelman.com. Orchard Garden Antiques is at orchardgardenantiques, one word, .co.uk. And where to see the Garden Museum is at gardenmuseum.org.uk. The Shaker Museum at shakermuseum, one word, .us. And Smithsonian Gardens Horticultural Artifacts Collection at gardens.si.edu/collections/artifacts. And a recommendation to read, Sutton's Seeds, A History, 1806 to 2006, by the Early Local History Group, Early spelled E-A-R-L-E-Y. We've recently shared a number of articles that talk about the advantages of native plants attracting birds and all sorts of avian creatures. We take a little different look, but step into the same issue with our next story by Hugo Cox, published on July 6th in the Financial Times of London, Gardening for Birds, How to Plant an Avian Oasis, the secrets to creating the most attractive corner of ecological real estate. You'll see more sunbirds here in a morning than you will anywhere in Kenya, declares a proud Nigel Carnelli. Perched on the end of a wooden sun lounger, I gaze through my binoculars at the curved beak native fowl feeding on the deep bank of red aloe flowers that borders the lawn. From the shaded terrace of his hillside bungalow, a two-hour drive north of Nairobi, Lake Naivasha's distant shore provides a shimmering backdrop. Bronze, variable, scarlet-chested, amethyst, golden-winged, malachite. The sunbirds' names check the brilliant colors that flare and vanish as they hover and dart, probing the long, bell-shaped flowers for nectar. As the border yields to a steep slope, Carnelli points out more bird-friendly planting. The flame-orange swirls of leonotus that also provide nectar, the bright yellow flowering crotalaria that host larvae, and later in the summer provide seeds. My mother started planting when my parents bought the house, and we've continued since then, he says. In 15 minutes, I count 7 sunbird species. Carnelli's gardener once counted 86 types of birds in 3 hours. This garden has been 60 years in the making, but gardeners across the world are embracing bird-friendly design with gusto. In the wake of the pandemic-era surge of interest in bird life, UK households are taking part in the RSPB's Big Garden Bird Watch, have increased by 30% since 2019. Applications for certified wildlife habitat status in the US have maintained their COVID-era levels, says Mary Phillips, who runs the program, which has certified more than 330,000 sites, including gardens, backyards, and community spaces since 1973 for the U.S. National Wildlife Federation. People want to make a difference, and with birds you can see the results almost within a season, she says. As conviction grows that even modest lawns and borders have a role to play in combating global biodiversity loss, gardeners are finding that bird-friendly planting can support rewilding and native species. In both the U.S. and the U.K., a relatively small number of native plants, such as oak, support a disproportionately large share of insect life, a crucial point given that insects are the primary food source for most garden birds during the breeding season. If you get the plants right, the rest will follow, says Phillips. On an April day in Lansing, West Sussex, Adrian Thomas is showing me the fruits of that approach, which have guided 10 years' work reshaping the acre of English garden he inherited as an overgrown lawn, a disused swimming pool, and a dusty chicken pen. The key, says Thomas, who also works as a volunteer garden expert for the RSPB, is not to go all out providing a complete range of avian amenities. Instead, the secret is to create the most attractive corner of ecological real estate. Providing the best in shelter, food, and water starts, he says, with plants, 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 and limiting lifeless surfaces such as paving or artificial grass. Birds move through a garden in stages, from tree to branch to shrub to ground, using a sequence of perches that allow them to feed while remaining close to cover. In a space full of disturbance, cats, dogs, people, those stepping stones are essential. Your garden may lack mature trees, but density can be created. Along one of his boundaries, Thomas points out a compact hedge wedge, a 3-foot square, 3-year-old cluster of hawthorn, blackthorn, field maple, bird cherry, and plum. House walls offer an artificial cliff. Covered with ivy or another thick creeper, they provide an appealing nesting and roosting site. Avoid pesticides. These kill the caterpillars, aphids, and other insects that birds feed on. Water, too, is essential. Ideally, a pond, he says, gesturing to one of two in the garden, bordered with common reed and lesser bulrush in place of hard paving, but clean bird baths if not. Nothing dead goes to waste, meanwhile. Leaves, logs, sticks, and compost piled throughout the garden provide essential insect habitats. In one corner, clippings from a small meadow are piled into a makeshift haystack, attracting insects and voles, whose presence has drawn kestrels and tawny owls to the plot. Gardens, while not exactly analogous to a woodland glade, can replicate it with a diversity of trees, hedges, flowering plants, and lawns, says Thomas. He cites the blackbird, which was almost exclusively a woodland bird until Victorian times when it ventured into gardens. The house sparrow has also adapted to human life. RSPB guidance advises against seeds or peanuts in bird feeders between May and October to help stem the spread of trichomoniasis disease, which has driven a 2/3 decline in green finch populations in the past 30 years, and which can spread at feeders. The advice, published in April, includes weekly cleaning and relocation of feeders and water baths, and avoiding sighting them in bird roosting areas. As an alternative to nuts in summer, try small amounts of mealworms, fat balls, or suet. Bird feeders are a valuable resource, notes Thomas, but only as part of a garden full of natural food. Conservationists caution against an exclusive focus on attracting birds, even rare ones, lest it reduce a garden's broader biodiversity. Protected areas are often designated specifically to help rare species, but the more common species appear to be falling through the cracks, says Rob Cook, lead author of a 2023 study by researchers from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. Nonetheless, global surveys reveal the increasing importance of home gardens to many familiar bird species, including blackbirds, robins, tits, and finches. Thanks to recent steep declines, starlings and house sparrows are now on the U.S. conservation red list, and gardens, including those in built-up areas, can provide vital habitats. Thomas asked for binoculars and a bird book for his 6th birthday, but not all bird-friendly gardeners start out as obsessives. When Pedro Carrasquillo bought a home with his husband for their retirement in Mashpee, Cape Cod, he simply knew he preferred the looser character of the local park to the manicured gardens of neighbors. I like to think it's an old Yankee tradition, the Cape Cod lawn. Mow once around Memorial Day in May, and then again in September on Labor Day, and in between just let nature do its thing, he says. It was a small plot, and he began by planting native shrubs such as inkberry and bayberry, and replacing deep layers of bark mulch with leaf litter gathered from the garden's own oaks. A ceramic birdbath, added almost as an afterthought, proved the turning point. Minutes after filling it, he watched from the kitchen window as the first visitors arrived. An American robin, finches, a pair of wood pigeons. The next day, I sat on the bench nearby. For the first time, I noticed the bird song, he says. Spurred by his new companions, Carrasquillo's efforts gathered pace. He added milkweed, trillium, lobelia, and scrub oak, alongside a handful of non-native nectar plants. Leaf piles were left undisturbed. Deadwood was stacked, a bee condo assembled from pine cones. Alongside rich insect life, salamanders and rabbits appeared. What struck me most was how few birds the surrounding gardens had by comparison, he said. Carrasquillo took 4 years to shape his Cape Cod bird garden. In Kenya, the Carnelli's 6 decades of work have embedded the garden deep into the surrounding hillside, echoing Thomas's precept that gardens should function as one part of birds' wider habitats. At dusk, I returned to the terrace, hoping for a repeat of the eagle owl that last night appeared on a nearby euphorbia candelabra tree. Carnelli hands me a Campari soda. The birdbath is quiet. A bulbul flits between bushes and on the lawn's edge. The sunbirds are still at work on the aloes. A week later, back in London, I unpack my binoculars to scan the neighbors' plots to picture the holistic habitat they present to local robins, blue tits, and pigeons. In my own, I tick off Thomas's requirements. No water, but plenty of plants. The bamboo screening the shed and established creepers masking a bright green aluminum fence provide good cover. There's some height in the palm, olive, and eucalyptus trees, and next door is towering mature sycamore. The garden wall of roses and a sprawling passion flower provide something for the insects. I'm pleasantly surprised with the results of my audit, but I can do more. I order a squirrel-proof bird feeder, mounting it near a shrub on which birds can perch. Typically, I have weeded out the wild garlic, self-seeded strawberry plants, and many of the wild grasses as they emerge in spring. This year, I leave them. I'm not going to conjure Lake Naivasha at sundown, but I'm confident the local birds will notice the upgrade. At least I'll find work for my new binoculars and that unopened bottle of Campari. An article by Hugo Cox, published on July 6th in the Financial Times of London, Gardening for Birds, How to Plant an Avian Oasis. That wraps up episode 353 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times, whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky. Gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.